There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We have merch. Check out the AmericanGlutton.net shop. We've got t-shirts, hoodies, hats, and more. A number of people have come up to me wearing American Glutton merch, and nothing fills my heart with more pride than seeing somebody in one of these t-shirts. And I've been stopped on the street and asked where to get it when somebody sees me in an American Glutton hoodie. Well, you can get it all at the shop on AmericanGlutton.net. And my favorite t-shirt, Yesterday It Was Tomorrow, Right Now, is up now. Get it while supplies last.
Hi, I'm Ethan Suplee. Welcome to American Glutton. Outside of acting, my two favorite things to do are diet and eat. I have a very complicated relationship with food, and on this podcast, we're going to talk about all of it. Food as entertainment, food as sport, food as fuel. I'll talk to experts and the average person, just like you and me.
I hate to ask you to do anything, but if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to like, subscribe, rate, review, all of the above on whatever app you're getting it from. Today, we welcome back Dr. Casey Means. She is the co-founder of Levels and has written a new book called Good Energy. Please enjoy. Dr. Casey Means, welcome back to American Glutton Podcast.
So good to see you again, Ethan. Thanks for having me on.
Nice to see you again, too. All right, you created Levels. Let's get all this stuff out of the way. We talked before about Levels, which is an amazing company that's helping lots of people to lose weight and become healthier. And now you have a book coming out called Good Energy.
That's right. Yes, Good Energy coming out soon. Good Energy, the surprising connection between metabolism and limitless health.
What is the connection between metabolism and limitless health? And also, you know, I have daughters, as I probably told you the last time we talked. I have daughters, and it's bandied about quite frequently amongst them and their friends that they have bad metabolisms.
Ooh.
And from my point of view, I'm like, I just think your metabolism is just a mathematical number. It's neither good nor bad. So what is this? What is the connection? What are we talking about here?
I truly believe that the state that we all want to get to, this like just limitless health, feeling like we can do whatever we want in this lifetime. We feel amazing. We have get up and go. We wake up in a positive mood. It's all rooted in metabolism. Metabolism is how we literally make energy in our cells. We have almost 40 trillion cells, and they're all just little machines. They're just little machines that want to do all this work every day to bubble up, to make us have these fabulous lives. But to do that, they need energy. They need cellular energy. And the way we get that cellular energy is we convert food. We convert the 70 metric tons of food we put in our mouths in our lifetime, and we've got to convert it to energy we can use to make those cells work. That's metabolism. And as you know, in 93% of American adults today, metabolism is under siege. It's problematic. We have metabolic dysfunction. This was 88% 5 years ago. Now it's 93% of Americans. It's going up and up. If the trends keep going, it's going to be all of us. Okay. So we're in this moment where we have to reorient really everything about our wellness choices, our dietary choices, our healthcare system, laser focused on how do we improve metabolic health. And ultimately, that comes down to how do we make our mitochondria function properly? Because like we all learn in high school biology, mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell. They are the thing that ultimately takes byproducts of that food that we eat, digestion products, and turns it to energy that we need to use. So mitochondria are sort of like they really get to the answer of your daughter's questions as well, which is, you know, I have a slow metabolism. What a bummer. This makes my life harder. And I think this is a myth that we have to debunk, this idea of I have a slow metabolism or I have a fast metabolism. So we can clip this and give it to your daughter. The reality is that the dozens and dozens of choices that we make every single day around all aspects of our diet and lifestyle, from our sleep consistency to whether we see light from the sun in the first hour of the day, to whether we are eating refined sugars or refined grains versus whole foods. Those decisions are what cultivate a fast metabolism, which is a choice we can make every single day. And what a fast metabolism really means is that we have mitochondria in our cells that are supported and working properly. And there's so many ways we can do that. And there's so many ways we can hurt it. So I'll give just one example that I think really helps really solidify that. A metabolism is a little machine inside our cell that makes energy. For that machine to work, just like a machine in a factory, it has all these little screws that have to be screwed in right for that machine to work. Those screws are basically micronutrients from our food. So for a mitochondria to work properly, we need vitamin C, magnesium, zinc, several B vitamins, manganese, several others. These are little screws that go into the machine. And when they're locked in tight, that machine can work properly. In our micronutrient deplete diet, because we are eating ultra processed foods and we are eating foods that come from soil that has been decimated by industrial agriculture, our food is profoundly micronutrient depleted. So now you've got a cell that can't reach out and grab the micronutrients it needs to basically put into the mitochondria to make it work properly. So what do you get? Slower metabolism, because the mitochondria don't have what they need to function properly. The same is true for several other elements of our diet and lifestyle. For instance, like morning sunlight, when you get those photons hitting your retina first thing in the morning, sends a signal to the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the brain, which sends a signal to your body that it is morning time, which turns on genetic pathways that literally tell our mitochondria to work properly. So that's another way that we can cultivate faster metabolism. So that's kind of a myth, I would say, that it's really something that we are or we are not. It's something that we can cultivate, and we cultivate it by focusing on nurturing the mitochondria.
So when you're thinking of metabolism, you're thinking about how well the body is functioning, how well it's deriving energy and putting that energy into use.
That's exactly right.
Versus just, and you know, when I think about metabolism, I'm literally just thinking of a number, like an energy as measured by a number, and going like, you know, because my main focus has always just been weight loss. And I will say, when I've tried weight loss in various forms, like I didn't do well on keto. I was fatigued all the time. Mm-hmm. But I will also say that, like, if I'm balancing my energy and I'm getting my calories from processed foods, I don't feel good either. Mm-hmm. If I'm getting them from whole foods or foods with one ingredient is what I try to aim for, like 90% of the time, mm-hmm. I feel great. But I'm still just thinking about a number.
That is so interesting. Like just different how people, I mean, I think everyone has their different conceptualizations with lots of Venn diagram overlap. A lot of the way I'm thinking about it is literally like, how do I have, if I'm trying to change potential energy into real energy. So the potential energy is the energy like stored in the molecular bonds of either food that I eat or food energy that is stored in my body, like triglycerides and fat and glycogen. There's all this potential energy that literally builds up as fat if we don't use it enough. So I'm thinking about how can I channel that through a pathway as effectively as possible to turn into real energy that I can use to be like a badass in life, you know, and like reach my highest purpose. And like, you've got to move those. And the way that you do that is by essentially processing it through the mitochondria. And so in my head, what I'm thinking about is like, basically, how do I have more mitochondria, younger mitochondria, better working mitochondria that are churning through more stuff, churning more potential into reality. And in doing so, generating heat, because that's what they do. So like getting me juicy and hot and, you know, like actually like a machine that's really going and not stagnant. So in my mind, everything I'm thinking about is through that lens. So when I'm picking up a heavy object, AKA resistance training, which is really just like, how do you put, when I think about resistance training, it's actually like, this is an energetic signal to a part of my body saying, you're not strong enough to lift this. Therefore, I need to make more of myself. The mitochondria are having this conversation to basically be able to help you do what you're trying to do. So it's a signal saying more mitochondria. So we know resistance training, muscle hypertrophy, mitochondrial biogenesis, more. Similarly, like here's another fun way you can kind of talk to your mitochondria. When we eat pomegranate seeds and pomegranate pith, the white stuff, they have elagitannins in them. And our microbiome convert those elagitannins from pomegranates to a byproduct called urolithin A. Urolithin A gets absorbed into our bloodstream and actually promotes what's called mitophagy, which is old dysfunctional mitochondria, essentially like dying and rebirthing to new mitochondria that do better work. And so when you just choose to eat certain things, when you choose to exercise in a certain way, a lot of that is actually communicating with your mitochondria to replicate, be more efficient, do more work. And so that's kind of the concept I'm thinking of, maybe as a very visual person, of like, really just like, how do I communicate in every possible language I can to tell my mitochondria to basically be faster?
Right. I mean, it's an amazing, like when you're, as you're describing it, I see like the intricacies of a machine spreading and, you know, little gadgets and gyroscopes here and, you know, nuts and bolts over here and everything's moving. It's a fascinating way to think about it. I mean, it's cool. It's just, I think, you know, you're a scientist. It's a much broader way to consider it than the way my dumb head, which is like, must lose fat. That's my number one target, you know?
There's a really fun video that people can look up, which is called, I think it's called The Life of a Cell, and it's done by Harvard. Have you ever seen this video?
Uh-uh.
It's like, it's so beautiful. It's an animated, like, but very like accurate visualization of inside a cell, basically everything that's happening. And what it does is it just like, I think having that visual of like, there is so much work going on in this cell every single moment. And like, in a sense, this is who I am. This is all I am. It's just inside all these little like protein machines working. And then remembering when you're watching that video, The Lives of a Cell or The Life of a Cell by Harvard, that, and there's dramatic music playing in the video, it's great, that every single thing you're looking at requires cellular energy to work properly. It all requires ATP. It's like a city, and it all requires ATP from the mitochondria, cellular energy to work. And so really like the fact that we have all these chronic diseases and all these symptoms that Americans are dealing with today, life expectancy literally going down in our country, in the wealthiest country in all of human civilization ever, life expectancy going down makes absolutely, literally no sense. I mean, we are spending more than any country in the world on healthcare, we're getting sicker. We have more gym memberships than any country in the world. We're among the fattest. We, you know, we are just absolutely flagrantly failing at keeping our population healthy. It's getting worse the more we do. So you have to stop and think, why? Why is that happening? Well, if you just think about first principles, it's probably because we're approaching the wrong problem or approaching the problem the wrong way. And my real mission in my work as a physician and with this book, Good Energy, is to help doctors and individuals and the healthcare system see if we pointed that huge amount of resources towards supporting mitochondrial health, letting cells function properly, so many symptoms and diseases would melt away. However, if we focus all that energy on drugs and surgeries that don't actually do anything to support true foundational cellular health from within, and instead just turn these little knobs on downstream biomarkers that make them, you know, hide a little bit more glucose in the cell by shoving some injected insulin in the body, or, you know, have a person essentially just sort of stop eating as much by injecting Wegovy in them, like things that don't, that change like little knobs on biomarkers, but don't actually help the inside of the cell function properly. We're never going to solve the real issue. So this more metabolic, mitochondrial, good energy focused framework, I think it's fundamentally critical for us to reorient towards if we're going to dig ourselves out of this hole. And I think we could dig ourselves out of this hole in the matter of years if we were focusing our arrow on the right target.
Okay. I have two questions, and then I want to run a theory by you. I'll do that last. Because I have a theory, like an origin story theory on all this. And I like to think about it. And this is the way my mind works. I don't know that it helps us at all, but it's, I want to hear your thoughts on my almost tinfoil hat theory. Okay.
That's, I can't wait.
We'll do that. And I also want to ask you about the GLP-1 inhibitor drugs. But before that, are you optimistic? Because like you seem like an optimistic person. And I will say, in fairness, I am not. I think individually, you're going to help a lot of individuals. I really do. I hope that anything, any of these conversations help individuals. But fuck, man. Casey, we're dealing with huge structural behemoth conglomerates worth trillions of dollars that you're literally saying, like, let's take this all apart and do something different.
Mm-hmm. I am optimistic. I'm completely optimistic. This book is such a book of optimism, and I'm optimistic. I would say, if I'm being totally honest, because I am a very spiritual person and I think we're being tested. And I think that this is a fascinating time in the sort of evolution of consciousness and humanity. And I think there are so many forces of light happening. You know, you like Joe Rogan, like people are some of the people who are really asking people to wake up and look at things differently are the largest people in all of, like, just crushing the mainstream narrative that's pushing, you know. And so, you know, there are forces of light that I think are happening that are getting people to kind of wake up and realize that it's possible. Those people have platforms like yourself, and it's amazing. And then I think about, like, I'm not a religious person. I don't subscribe to like a religious doctrine, but you look at like look at what happened with like Jesus or like Buddha or like other people. Like, there are movements that have totally changed the course of the world through small groups of people. And I heard this amazing like quantum physicist who like was talking about like some quote of like small islands of cohesion actually can shift the whole, like in the quantum. And there's all these amazing things in quantum, like the butterfly effect, like entanglement theory, where like things happening at one part of the universe are affecting things. Like, I mean, we live in an infinite expanding universe. Like, shit is crazy. Can we turn the obesity epidemic around? Of course we can.
Oh, no, I have no, yes.
Yeah. So that's where I'm sitting, of like, what if it's actually like, what if like a lot of us need to like meditate together and like bring the consciousness to a higher level. And like, maybe some guy, you know, the CEO of Nestle, like, wakes up one morning and is like, oh shit, this is bad. Like, we got to change it all. And that has actually happened. Like, there's an amazing thing that happened in Kuwait, actually. There's the Nestle of the Middle East is called KDD. And I think it's Kuwaiti Dairy something, but they have like 250 ultra processed, super high sugar products. And the Middle East is getting decimated by obesity and diabetes. Like, it is worse than the US. So this guy, multi-billionaire running KDD, he picks up Rob Lustig's book. He picks up like Metabolical or Fat Chance or one of Dr. Rob Lustig's books. Someone sends it to him because his diabetes is really bad. He reads it and he's like, oh, damn it. Like, we got to change everything. He brings Rob Lustig out to the Middle East, gives them all the resources in the world. They get the sugar out of all their products. Like, so it's like, there's just interesting things happening. And
that's amazing.
I absolutely think
that's
it could
huge
change. Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, it could change in years. I think it's going to take a global, interesting awakening that's going to, you know, be more than just cognitive. I think it's also going to be people. I believe that one of the biggest acts of resistance that we can do is actually be optimistic. And the more that I think people can shift their consciousness to saying, like, I believe in people, I believe in this beautiful duality of humanity, that we are these incredible beings that have more power than we could possibly understand. And if we can collectively think about a better vision for humanity, we can create it. Like, and I think right now the actually worst part thing happening right now in society is that people are pessimistic. And I think that is an entrenched sense of disempowerment that has been programmed into us in our society. And that, you know, I think, like, if everyone listening to this actually just sits and for 5 minutes and meditates on the fact that we actually as humanity can create anything we want, we are these incredible beings. Like, that's the first step. So yeah, very optimistic.
That's amazing. I appreciate your optimism. I think it's infectious too, because as you're talking, I started to feel more optimistic, which, you know, listen, it took me 15 years of fighting, like, almost constantly to, you know, and a lot of that was that I'd achieve weight loss and then gain the weight back and then fight my way back into weight loss and then gain the weight back. And so, you know, there were kind of principles that I live by today, which 15 years ago, I would say, like, no, I'm doing that. Like, it took like a radical perspective shift for me to even see, like, oh, I wasn't doing that at all. You know, like, giving up bread is not, that's not the battle for me. Like, it's not going to solve anything. You know what I mean? It didn't change my life. But, you know, 15 years ago, I would have said, no, I'm doing lifestyle change. I've given up bread. And that was, to me, should have been enough. And so having this conversation with people where it's like, you know, you might have to radically, like, the way you live your day-to-day life in America, or the way I did, which was like, if I'm hungry at 2 o'clock in the morning, I've got fast food, I've got 7-Eleven, I've got AM, PM, I'm presented with food everywhere, every point of commerce that I go to buy something, I'm presented with food. And that was my interaction with food, right? Like,
yes,
that is totally the antithesis of my interaction with food today. Like, it took a redesign to the way I live my life. And I don't know that had you written it all out for me in that way 15 years ago, or 20 plus years ago now, I don't know that I don't know that I'm willing to do it. I might've just said, like, no, I can't do that, you know? And today here I am living a different life, much happier, feeling much better, much healthier. And going, like, I wish I'd come to this earlier. That's why I'm pessimistic. It's not an easy conversation, because I think when you're in it, it's just hard to understand how much every part of your life is dictated by it.
Yeah. And I think the other hard thing is that everyone comes to their sort of like awakening moment of like the turning point. It can be slow for some people. It can be long for some people. You know, it can, and it could be from like 100 little drips of information that finally take hold, or it could just be like you hear one thing and you like never touch a cigarette or a French fry again. Like, so it's there's not one playbook, you know. Like the barriers could be from childhood trauma. The barriers could be from the just generally the food you're around. Like it's just all the, I mean, I personally, like my own journey, I don't know if we talked about this on our first episode, but like I was very, very overweight as a child. I was 215 pounds in seventh grade, you know, very, very big. And when I think about the change for me, I lost all the weight. I lost all the weight when I was 14. So I lost about 65 pounds my freshman year of high school. And then I gained it all back in college because I was super stressed out. And then I lost it again. And I've been this basically the same weight for like 15 years now. But, you know, it's the two ways that I did it, the first and second time, are completely different. Like the first time, it was literally that everyone was getting invited to school dances and I wasn't. And I was like, fuck this. Like
just through sheer willpower, I will be smaller.
I was like, this sucks so much. That like not eating junk food sucks less.
Right.
Like it was like, that was, and I mean, it was more than that, but it was more of like a flip switch where I was like, I went to the library, I checked out a bunch of books about food. It was like Eat Fat, Get Thin, like these old, and like, I just decided I would cook all my food for like 6 months and go to the gym every day. And it was actually quite healthy how I did it. But I announced to my parents, like, I'm cooking all my own food. And I need a gym membership. And I took the bus there and I was like a maniac. And then I came back sophomore year and honestly, like, hate to say it, like I did get invited to dances that year. Now, that was actually a very interesting life experience for me because it actually was not, I did not experience the joy, obviously, that I thought I would get because I actually was completely disillusioned with humanity at that
point. It feels hurtful.
Like, I'm like, I'm the same person. Like this is, and I thought I always feel like I looked great, like either way. And I'm just like, people suck. This is annoying, you know? And so that was kind of an interesting 14-year-old wake up call where I was like, wow, this is, our world is really tough, like really set up for some, you know, some superficial things. And then the second time when I was in college, college was stressful. I was pre-med, all this stuff. I ended up gaining all the weight back. And that was really frustrating. And then that was actually more, I moved to New York after college. And I just was walking all the time and it just kind of slowly, you know, and I had a kitchen, I'd been in dorm food in college and then I had a kitchen in New York and it was much more just like gradual. Like, so it's just, yeah, all that is to say, like, everyone's journey is so different and there's, and that makes it challenging, but I think also optimistic in a way because there are a lot of wonderful resources out there. And, you know, I think it's funny. I'm now at a place where I think about what keeps me healthy, what gets me up every day to do the health behaviors and like to actually go to the farmer's market and cook all my food from scratch and stay in this healthy state now. And to me, if you ask me that question, it's like, it all comes from a sense of awe. Like I am in awe of this precious human experience that we have. Like we are, our bodies and our mitochondria are literally transformers of cosmic energy into human consciousness. And that I just meditate on that. I think about that. And I'm just like, I have to do what I can to put all the tools into this body through my choices to let that process just be as free as possible. Because literally the chemical energy in our food that we unlock in metabolism to create our lives is the sun's energy. It's literally solar energy that is stored in chemical bonds from plants and that we then unlock the sun's energy to power our consciousness. I'm like, that's freaking amazing. I want to support that. That's beautiful. But that rationale would not have motivated my 14-year-old self like at all. Right. So it's just funny like how I could speak to that right now. Maybe that inspires someone, that kind of sense of deep gratitude for this precious time. But, it certainly wasn't the thing that probably would have motivated me at 21 and 14. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's like, I think about, my brain thinks in analogies and a lot of the time I'm thinking like, okay, our body's just like a machine. Think of your car And would you put, you know, this high octane rocket fuel into your car if it allowed you to drive really fast, but it was damaging to the car? And I'd go like, no, because I generally don't need to drive really fast. If one day a year I like wanted to go drag race somebody, maybe. And it's honestly the same thing for me today. Like, if I go to the gym and I have cardio that day, which means I'm not in New York because, like you said, you walk a lot in New York and I don't need to do extra cardio. But like in my life outside of New York, which is the majority of the time, I'll sit most of the day, which I don't like. Makes me feel. So I'll go and do cardio. And if in the middle of cardio, I hit a wall, and it doesn't happen very often, but sometimes it does, I'll eat a little bit of sugar and feel great and get through my cardio. If I do that same thing at night and I'm sitting in a chair and I eat that sugar and then I go to bed, I will wake up hungover. And that's just, it took me a while to like of trial and error to go, it's not worth it, you know, but I've had the same, it becomes unfortunate with food because you can't give up food, but I'm a sober person also. And it took me a while to go like, oh, I have to kind of apply the same principles that I do with drugs and alcohol to food, because my interaction with them is so similar. I'm doing it out of boredom, out of anxiety, or even sometimes in celebration, out of joy. Those were like my prime reasons for using drugs. You know, the universe is scary. Let me use some drugs or eat something. It'll make me feel better. And I can't do that anymore. Which is a better life for me. Like you have your experience, I have mine. I don't think we have to apply that to everyone, but that is my experience. I have to get really honest about what am I getting out of this? And that doesn't mean I can't enjoy food and it can't taste good, but it can't be this kind of manic or depressive crutch.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Your theories. We missed your
theories. I don't know. We have one other topic
before
theories. And the theories, again, are tinfoil hat theories. They're not, they're like the little bit of science is it's a patchwork. GLP-1 inhibitors. What are your thoughts?
My belief about the GLP-1 agonist is that.
Agonist, sorry, not inhibitor.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. Is that. They represent the pinnacle of the gullibility, I think, of the human species. You know, the fact that we can sit here and think and literally convince ourselves that the solution to a profoundly toxic environment is a lifelong injection is like one of the saddest things I've ever witnessed in my lifetime. It's sad because we have been blessed with these incredible brains as humans and we're not using them. And we're just choosing to be totally blind and simplistic when faced with this false god, you know, of this sort of silver bullet that's not real. I mean, like, and I don't even care what the data says truly, like, because it's like, yeah, of course people can lose weight on this drug. Of course, maybe some of their metabolic biomarkers get better, but we are living in literally a toxic soup of cellularly massacring chemicals and inputs that are decimating our human thriving, our children's health, our life expectancy is going down. People are getting Alzheimer's at age 50. You know, this is all, it's all happening. We know why, we understand why our cells are breaking. And because it seems hard to fix that, we're all just immediately sort of thinking that this injection is a savior. And there's something just so dystopian about the fact that it's an injection too. You know, it's like a lifelong injection. And somehow we're convincing ourselves that this is innovation. So no knock on the fact that it actually does have some effect in helping people lose weight. Like, we don't even need to get down the whole conversation about like more muscle, lean mass is lost than we want it to. The fact is, it's not a solution to the problem, because the problem is an environmental obesogenic world that we're living in that is totally because of profit and capitalism. And I'm not in any way like anti-capitalist. It's like, that's the reality though. Healthcare, processed food, agriculture, and the chemical industry together make up over $12 trillion of industry in the United States alone. Those are all businesses that are designed to grow. The way they grow is you have more patients going through the healthcare system. You have more people addicted to processed food. You have more chemicals in all our products. And you have an industrial agriculture system that uses tons of technology that we really don't need. And all of that circles together to make us sick and make us hyper profitable. And now you throw on another medication to make industry more profitable with not actually making people healthy. So I think it's very dystopian. And it's, you know, this is the most simple example, but it's like, if you had, and it's been said before, I did not make this up, but I think it's the perfect example for the Ozempic conversation. If you had a fish in a tank filled with dirty, gray, chemical filled water, and that fish was sick, would you give that fish a lifelong injection, or would you change the water? Obviously, you change the water. So that's kind of where we're at. Those are my thoughts on Ozempic. It's like, I think that Novo Nordisk, which is based in Europe, I think they're laughing at us. I think they know what they're doing, and I think it's a very sad situation. And then you've got a lot of people capitalizing this on saying, you know, it's like wrong to deny people access to this or not have taxpayer money go towards this because people need it. But what I always say is, why don't we, with our huge, big, smart brains, think about if we're going to, this is on track to be the largest grossing medication in human history, and it's going to be taxpayer funded. So if we just step back for 5 minutes and thought, what if we put those potentially trillions of dollars towards reforming our food system, you know, and doing other things that actually get at the root cause, let's just have that conversation. And then the first thing we'll say is, it's too complicated. It's too big. It's just too complex. You don't think it's complex to inject hundreds of millions of people every week with a drug? That's complex too, you know? And it's like that just seems easy. Do you know how hard it is to get a 12-year-old to get a shot? Like, so it's just, yeah, those are my thoughts. I would love to hear your thoughts.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, look, I have many thoughts. I have thoughts of like, I've read papers that suggest that, you know, exercise is a better cure for mood disorders than SSRIs. I've read those papers. They seem pretty convincing to me. So like, and the reason, the thing that keeps me going to the gym 6 days a week is not that I'm trying to put on muscle. I'm not. It's not that I think I'm there losing weight. I'm not. That's not where I lose, where or how I lose weight. I go to the gym every day because it makes me feel better, because I come out of the gym happier and the people around me subsequently are happier. And that's my motivation to go to the gym. So it, like you're saying, I can't get totally down on pharmaceuticals. I have a daughter with type 1 diabetes. She takes insulin every single day and it saved her life. So I'm not like an anti-pharmaceutical guy, but I for sure would prefer, I prefer in my life to, you know, to address my environment or me, or if there's anything I can do to avoid the sickness, if my, you know, LDL skyrockets, my first choice is not going to be a statin. It's going to be increased fiber, increased omega-3s, decreased, you know, omega-6s. And that would be how I would try to tackle it. So I agree. Change the water. I think that's a much better solution. However, I was obese the majority of my life, and then for 15 years struggled almost every day with just the back and forth of gaining and losing weight. There's no way, if this had come out 5 years ago, I wouldn't be on it. Not possible. I would be on it for sure. There's even a part of me today that thinks, wouldn't it be great if I could just take that shot and then not have to think about food the way I do every day? My fear is all of the bad habits that I talked to you about, my behavior with food, would come back. They would just be blunted by this drug. And that to me isn't tempting, because that behavior is really, really dangerous for me. So personally, it's like, I'm really glad I figured this out prior to the advent of those being on the market for weight loss, or got my life in order in the way I did. For somebody who's morbidly obese and is going to take the shot and has tried dieting, I'm only happy if they become more happy in life.
Right.
For the other pool, who I think it's going to capture even more than the morbidly obese, which is like my wife's friends, I fear terribly that it's going to act as any of their yo-yo diets did, which I've tried to have countless conversations with many of them time and time again, saying, if you lose weight too rapidly, you sacrifice lean tissue, you then gain the weight back, you're gaining back fat, not gaining back lean tissue. Year over year, your weight stays the same, but your body fat percentage, in fact, rises, which is really, really scary. And that's what I think we're going to see en masse, is that the American population's weight, until it becomes really cheap and available to everyone. But I'm hearing people are doing like a 3-month deal of this stuff, or you can buy it in 4-week blocks. Like, I'm like, no, that's not at all what that drug is meant. That's not how it's supposed to be used. It is a lifetime drug, like, you know, insulin for a diabetic. So you do it for 3 or 4 weeks or 4 months or however long, and then you come off, you're fucking hungry. You're going to eat. If you didn't put into place any guardrails and safeguards, and if you can put those guardrails and safeguards, what is the point of the drug? It makes crash dieting easier. And so I do believe, unless people are going into it going, I'm going to use this to settle the food noise, I'm going to eat a high protein diet, I'm going to do some resistance training, I'm going to reshape my life with this drug, and then get off of it and see how it goes. But I think that's probably not going to be the majority of people.
Right.
So I'm scared. It's another reason that I'm ultimately pessimistic, because I know for sure, had you know, you hear about how great Ozempic is, and then you hear about there's another one that's even better. And like, that would have been such a strong calling to me a number of years ago. And even when I think through the implications of it in my life today, I'm like, all that does, the only thing that affords me today is bad habits.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have so much compassion for people who, you know, want to take it. And like, I understand all the reasons. And I think for there are always going to be individuals who are going to, like you said, like take this and become happier and feel better. And that's amazing. So this is not a knock on, you know, any individual choices around using this. And maybe this is the gateway for some people. Cause you know, wins beget wins. And so if you start to feel better, and this is similar for SSRIs. I think some people on SSRIs are going to feel better and then be able to finally take the steps they've been wanting to take to actually build the comprehensive holistic lifestyle that will help them maintain for the long run. And so that's the best case scenario for sure. Of course, feel better, have the energy and the motivation to do all the things. I think from the systems level perspective,
yeah,
that's where I really feel like it's a knock on humanity. We're like, how could we possibly think, you know, obesity basically didn't exist 100 years ago. You know, now it's over 40% of the adult population. So it's like, this is obviously the, you know, modern industrial world that we're living in is just basically a signal to our body to print fat. And we have to take away the signal that tells our body to print fat. And it's actually that simple. Like it's if we could go back to creating a world where we understand like what is happening in our cells and then deconstruct those forces through like policy and like programs and education and all the basic levers that make a functioning civilization, you know, thrive and work. Like, but it's what I mean by, I really feel like it's our gullibility. It's like we think it's the hubris of humanity. I think that we've seen several times of like, we see something that seems like a simple fix and we get so excited and it distracts us from the work that actually has to be done. And so, that's the part that just scares me a little bit because.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. It's scary. Yeah. It is scary. Okay. Now my theory.
Okay.
If we go back, I believe it was like World War I. I think it was World War II. There's like beef and lamb rationing in America. There's a lot of the young men leave. There's suddenly shortages of everything. That's where you start to see chicken become industrialized because they just weren't letting people buy and eat pork and beef in the amounts that they could. And you see processed foods. That's where we get like the Wonder Bread is invented. And the definition of bread, this is like my favorite part of Michael Pollan's book, where it goes from three, legally bread had three ingredients, right? Water, salt, flour. That was it. That was bread. And then
legally.
And then it was like, no. We have to change it because we're now able to keep bread on shelves for weeks at a time, where before it was like, you got a day, you bake the bread, people eat the bread. That's it. Now it's like, no, we don't have young men to like interact with the bread, and whatever the reason, suddenly bread goes from having three ingredients to 13, and then there's no vitamins in it. So they start figuring all that out. Now it's got like 30, legally it's got 30 ingredients, which is crazy. I didn't even know foods legally had listed ingredients. Bread's got a lot today. So we have all that. We see processed food enter, and not long after World War I is kind of when dieting became in fashion. It's really the 1950s where you suddenly have the first diet books going around America. And there were sane people back then. There was like Adele Davis. I don't think she was 1950s, but she wasn't long after that. And she was pretty rational. But you had all kinds of weird diets back then. You had diets where it was like, you can have your white wine and an egg, and then you get your pack of cigarettes and that's your diet, right? Like that was in a magazine. I remember reading that. I forget what it was called, but it was like a diet that was a bottle of white wine and like three hard boiled eggs.
No.
Yeah. Something really crazy. It was like it was a recommended diet, but here's the position I start with. I start with today, science is telling us this is now a genetic condition. Okay, it takes a million years to evolve. It takes 1,000 generations to have some evolutionary change happen. And we have seen this occur in less than 100 years. Less than 100 years. So saying that there's some genetic change that occurred in less than 100 years to me is just crazy. But I do know there are epigenetic shifts that can happen. There was a study done called the Dutch Hunger Winter where you took a starving populace and then their children, like a mother who was pregnant at the time with a kid and she experienced famine. Her kid was something like 10 or 15 times more likely to experience obesity and type 2 diabetes. Yeah. My theory is this. We introduce processed food, weight starts to tick up, diet culture takes hold, you suddenly have people starving themselves, because that's what a lot of those diets are. They literally are starvation diets, which is turning on whatever this epigenetic thing is that's going like, we're fucking just experienced famine. Not again. We're going to hold on to as much weight as we possibly can. We're going to, you know, we're going to make you crave sugars and sweets more. And then the confounding factor here is that obesity is also contagious. It's socially contagious. So we have food, very, very inexpensive, non-nutritious abundance of food, along with the diet culture, which just compounds everything. So this epigenetic thing has occurred spread out across America. So when you hear people say it's genetic, yeah, there's a genetic component because there are going to be people who are more prone to retaining fat, to being hungrier, to type 2 diabetes. But why is that? Why are so many people experiencing that? There's no evolutionary shift in such a short period of time. So I think it's environmental. This is my tinfoil hat conspiracy, that we've gotten ourselves into this mess just with a series of bad decisions.
Oh my gosh.
It's not a bad theory, well, right?
I love a good theory. Like this is how it happened, right? You try on these things and like then of course it all becomes like, oh yeah, that's actually what was shown by the science. But I mean, I think it's such what you bring up is such an important point, which is that well, first of all, there's this big push right recently towards calling obesity genetic, and this has been pushed forward by Dr. Fatima Stanford, who got on 60 Minutes and talked about how obesity is a genetic brain disease. And it wasn't disclosed in that episode that she is on the payroll of Novo Nordisk, which makes Ozempic.
Which is handling exactly. Right. Which is like, you can't do anything about it in the real world. So take this drug.
Right. And pharma pays for 60% of mainstream media advertising. So it all makes sense, you know, and if you can call it a genetic disease and you can call obesity a chronic disease and start to really bring that into the zeitgeist and start to really, you know, everyone just like, oh yeah, of course, you know, without really thinking.
Where was it 100 years ago?
Right, exactly.
Did our genes change so radically 100 years ago?
But there's a whole
purpose. Is that possible?
Right. Yeah. No. And there's a whole purpose for this push towards the really trying to get into the zeitgeist that it's a genetic disease. Even though, like you said, genes haven't changed in 100 years. Our genetic code has not meaningfully changed in 100 years. Because
can change at all in 100
years. Right. Like mutations obviously can happen, but not like...
Not half the population.
But when that becomes the language and the zeitgeist, then you can start to call these treatments basically things that can make it onto the insurance registries and start to get them paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. And it's a whole sequence and plan that basically is pushing towards getting taxpayer funding for these medications. But you have to start by changing the language around it. So that's number one. But I think the other piece that you get at it that's so important is that, yes, I think there are massive epigenetic changes happening that are leading to obesity. And this is very clear in the science as well, that the way that our genetic code is folded and the way it's being expressed, which are things that can change within days and are heritable, the folding changes of the genome, those are readily impacted by our environment. But so it's basically the genes changing in response to environment, but we should not be calling those the same things, like calling it a genetic disease, because that really is a lifestyle and dietary issue and a stress issue. Like you said, psychological stressors and things like starvation, those things can change the epigenetics. But like, there's a paper that I was looking at for my book. I was just pulling it up. It's like from a couple years ago, but like persistent epigenetic reprogramming of sweet taste by diet. So what you're eating actually changing the taste preferences via folding of the genome. But to me, this is extremely motivating because, like, okay, if I can just kind of like grit my teeth and get through some of the hard lifestyle choices, I have the opportunity to change the folding and expression of my genome in a way that's going to make me less crave sweet food in the future. So it's like, I think about this a lot. Like, if you can muster through like the hard part of like the beginning of like eating the real food and like getting, you know, more steps in and whatnot, like get off the dopamine cycle, change the microbiome, change your epigenetics. And once those things starts happening with like the brute force willpower, everything gets easier, right? Because like things have actually changed from within. So sometimes I would tell my patients in my functional medicine practice who are like, the biggest barrier to me eating healthy is I do not have time to cook because I'm, you know, a night nurse and I'm working all the time. And I'm like, listen, you like, so they like healthy food, but they just can't fit it into their life. I'm like, order a month of Daily Harvest, you know, like direct to your door, just like 90 meals and just eat. And it's all, you know, like organic, real food, unprocessed, just like eat that for like every meal for 30 days. And, you know, or I guess this is kind of like the patients I had that they didn't have time to cook and they, you know, so they were eating a lot of processed food, but like they were open to eating something different if it were easy. And I'm like, by that time, the 30 days is up. If you just make it easy on yourself to do this, your brain will have changed. Your microbiome will have changed. Your reward circuitry will have changed. Your epigenetics may have changed. And then everything else kind of moving forward will be easier. So it's like, I don't know if that resonates with you. Like it's just like, once you kind of do a little inch, like some of the stuff starts unfolding and feels a little bit more effortless. And one other thing with the GLPs, it's like what's, you know, you mentioned your daughter, like she needs insulin because of type 1 diabetes, but I don't even see those really as a parallel because her body doesn't make insulin. So she needs insulin. And so it's true. That is in a sense, getting to the root cause. Like she doesn't make it, it's being replaced. But the thing about GLPs is that we can stimulate GLP production through our choices, like eating protein and whole foods and other behaviors actually can stimulate us to, so we can be our own GLP-1 agonizers in a sense by like making choices. Whereas like for someone with type 1 diabetes, like they can't just like stimulate their body to make more insulin. So in that first case, the diabetes, it's like, there's really like a root cause place for like an injection. And then for the GLP side, it's like, we should really be exhausting all the lifestyle choices that can stimulate GLP-1, you know, because there is that option available to us.
That's a great point. It's true. Like if I eat chicken breasts and cabbage, I'm going to get full and I'm not going to have overeaten. And that's just, even just by volume, I'm going to get full versus donuts take up a lot less space. And you know, will leave me feeling shitty, but I'll have some kind of euphoria while I'm eating them. And that's literally the trade. Well, I want to only be able to eat one donut instead of 12, but I, oh, you know, I'm with you. It's a scary thing. Dr. Means, this has been another fantastic conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I can't wait to read Good Energy too. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you. Well, it's filled with lots of strategies that really all focus on stimulating that mitochondria to do its best work. I mean, it's, like I said, I really think if we can point the arrow towards the mitochondria with our choices and understand why we're doing them to help our mitochondria, it just makes things a lot easier and feel less random in our health journey. So, certainly for anyone who's feeling like, oh my gosh, I have a slow metabolism, I want a fast metabolism. Like, I think it's possible for everyone. And, a lot of it's about just orienting our energy towards nurturing the mitochondria with good things and the nutrients and the diet that it needs and lifestyle, all sorts of things, and then taking away the things that hurt it, you know? And so that's a whole nother set of things that many people aren't aware of. Like, some of the things in our personal care products and home products and things like that. So it's very straightforward and hopefully will really help people who are on that metabolic health journey, focus their arrow in an easier way. So
amazing. Can't wait. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now for the Q&A.
Today's question comes from Micah.
Hi, Micah.
He says, what is the best way to figure out what your maintenance calories are in order to put yourself in a proper calorie deficit?
I think the best way is to go to Google basal BMR calculator, basal metabolic rate calculator, and then Google will give you options. Doesn't matter. Type in all the information you can into one of those, get that number, and try to hit that number pretty accurately without changing anything in your life for a couple of weeks and see if you maintain your weight. And if your weight comes down, the calories are low. And if the weight goes up, the calories are high. That is how I did it the very first time I figured it out. And now, you know, if I'm dieting for a while and weight loss starts to slow, I'll chip down at the calories a little bit. And then when I come into maintenance, if my weight goes up, you know, the first day or two, it could be because some of my calories are from carbohydrates, and carbohydrates hold store liquid in your muscles. So that can show an effect on the scale that's not fat gained, but then it'll balance out, you know. And as long as my weight is staying relatively static, you know, a pound up or down or a couple pounds up or down, that then come back based on, you know, how much salt I had the day before, or how much water I had the day before. That's how I figure it out.
Love it. Can I ask you a question just because you said BMR? So BMI, I know, is body mass index.
Yeah.
So people say that you can go online and kind of figure that out too, right? You put in your age and your weight and your height and your thing, but like, isn't that influenced also by how much fat versus muscle you have?
Body mass index is a kind of a gross, and I don't say gross with the definition of disgusting, number that is based on your height. I believe it's height, weight, and age. Maybe age doesn't have anything to do with it, height and weight, but I think age might play a part in it too.
I see. Right.
So how tall are you and what do you weigh? Mm-hmm. Boom, that's your body mass index, because it's just how much mass you have and how far in space it's spread, how vertical it's spread. The tricky thing about BMI is that it doesn't, like a lot of athletes, because they have excess muscle mass, will skew higher on the BMI, and it doesn't mean they're unhealthy. So it as a number, you know, I am 15% body fat today, which is far below the national average. Mm-hmm. And I'm also overweight on the BMI. You know, the amount of muscle that I'm carrying around, I'm a big dude, is probably taxing my body a little bit. And so it's not necessarily ideal for longevity, but I'm not at the point where I have so much muscle that I'm obese. Or, you know, if you look at some of those bodybuilders, the real muscle mass guys, they're obese, period, on the BMI. Or even morbidly obese. They're very heavy, and some of them are not very tall. And so, but like, you know, I'm sure LeBron James is overweight.
Right.
Most football players, and there are some that are legitimately overweight, but most of them are overweight. You know, athletes have a hard time if you have extra muscle mass. So the better calculation is, what is your body fat percentage? Figuring that out is probably a better gauge of like how much weight you should gain or lose, you know, in a healthy manner to achieve health. That's the problem with the BMI.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Got it. Well, I'm sorry to hijack Micah's question.
But no, all good. I appreciate it.
Abbreviations got me. Thanks, Micah. Let us know how that goes for you. If anyone else has a question for Ethan, you can email it to us. The address is hello@americanglutton.net.
And now for the Q&A.
Here's a question from Patrick.
Hi, Patrick.
He says, I'm looking for some direction here. What do I do when I have tried everything to lose weight? I've tried eating fish, chicken, vegetarian, limiting calories to half of what I should be eating. I've tried topiramate, phentermine, Saxenda, Wegovy, keto. I've tried to talk to dietitians and nutritionists. Now I'm 3 weeks into carnivore, but nothing has worked. What do I try next? What do you recommend for me now? I feel a little hopeless. I'm not extreme in size, but very uncomfortable. 6 foot, 285. I gained over 100 pounds from 2009 to 2018, and I can't get rid of it. Lately, I have been weightlifting mostly 3 times a week. I'm going to keep on the carnivore and weights for now, but is there anything you can suggest for me? Everything I have tried has given me 0 results except keto, which I know is not sustainable, and I'm feeling very discouraged.
Well, it's very confusing to me, thank you for the question, that keto worked and carnivore isn't, and how did keto work? And I don't understand. I ate half the calories I'm supposed to and didn't lose any weight. Like, none of that, it just doesn't make sense. So unless there's some like severe structural anomaly with his endocrine system and his hormones are all messed up and his thyroid is all messed up, which I would suggest he has checked out. But if he's been to doctors, he said he was been to doctors, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would think they would tax something like that.
He says dietitians and nutritionists. So
okay,
say
well, maybe go get some blood drawn from a doctor and see if there's something like actually wrong with your hormones, like your thyroid or something like that, because eating half the calories, that just doesn't make any sense. If you require 1,000 calories a day, if you require 2,000 calories a day and you're eating 1,000, where's your body getting that energy from? It's got to come from somewhere. This is not, you know, it is actually like, I don't believe in absolutes, but you can't beat thermodynamics. How are you beating thermodynamics? Your body is burning fuel. And if you're not putting it into your body, it's coming from your body. It's coming mm-hmm. from your muscle, your fat. So you would see some movement on the scale. I think a lot of trouble comes with calorie counting in that people are eyeballing stuff and making assumptions, and they're just bad at estimating. You know, and then there's can be other problems. And like if you do it for a day and you go like, I should have lost a pound today. I start calorie counting and I don't give it much time at all. And then, you know, I give it a day and I don't see any change on the scale. And I'm like, well, that didn't work. Like how much time are you putting into this and expecting to see a result? The other thing with keto that I would say is like, did you do it for 2 weeks and you saw a big result and then it stalled because the result you saw was likely mostly water. Mm. You stop eating carbohydrates, your body is storing a ton of glucose in your muscles that is dependent on carbohydrates. If you stop eating them, it's going to purge them. That's a big difference on the scale that can be 10 pounds on the scale that is no fat. It's only water. So is that what you saw? Or did you do keto and lose 100 pounds and then put it back on? Like there's too much that I don't know, but I do know you can't beat thermodynamics. You can't. If your body, it's like saying, you know, my car ran out of gas, but I was still able to drive 50 miles. Well, then your car didn't run out of gas because you can't drive a car without gas. It doesn't work. And the body has stores of food in the form of fat and, you know, if it has to, muscle. And it's going to eat that and you're going to see a difference on the scale if you're not putting enough into it. So I don't know. Maybe your metabolism is way, way lower than you think and you need to cut 25% from where you were, or I don't know what to say, but carnivore not producing any result doesn't make sense to me at all because at a minimum, I would expect to see a loss of water, hydration, because you're not eating carbs, unless you're doing carnivore and like chugging. There's some versions of carnivore where people are eating honey and berries. And if you're eating a shitload of that stuff, then you're not going to get rid of your glycogen stores. And so you're not going to lose that water. And so maybe you're just not even in a caloric deficit because that is what, if you're losing fat, it's because your body does not have enough energy to sustain itself based on what you're putting into it. And it's got to tap into its savings account.
Gotcha.
You know, imagine like, your bank account and you have bills every month. And if you're making more money than you need to pay your bills, your savings account goes up. And if you're not making enough to cover your bills, your savings account goes down. That is what fat is. Fat is your savings account. Mm-hmm. And money is energy, calories. That's like just any of the foods. Your body burns that as fuel and it powers your body. And if you don't put enough in, so I don't know. If keto worked, go back on keto. But like if you did keto for 2 weeks and saw 10 pounds and then the next week you didn't lose any weight, the reason is the weight you lost was water, and the remain and then you stalled out because you were eating too much. Yeah. I gained weight while eating keto. Perfect adherence to keto. Once the liquid and glycogen stores were tapped, I just wouldn't lose weight anymore until I actually ate less, and then I would lose weight. And so that wasn't as fun for me as just eating in a slight deficit while eating some carbs too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gotcha. And key that you said he should see a doctor, right? Because who knows what is going on. That
yeah, if you're weighing your food, if you go on Google and you go like, how many calories should I eat, and it spits out 2,000 or 20, whatever. 6 foot tall, and how much does he weigh? 200 plus pounds.
Yeah, 285.
285. 6 foot tall, 285. Could probably be in a deficit at 2,500 calories. And he's saying he ate half of that. So if he's eating 1,250 calories a day and not losing weight, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. You know, unless your calorie calculation was way off, or you're actually consuming more, your estimations or your calculations on what your calorie intake is off.
Yeah. Gotcha. Good. Well, thanks for the question. You know, Patrick, let us know how it goes. Take that advice to get to a doctor and get some stuff, you know, get some baseline.
Yeah. And let me say one other thing. There could be some autoimmune issue where the guy, you know, I think this is incredibly rare, where the guy has some, you know, immune reaction to complex carbohydrates. And then I go like, okay, if keto was working, don't stop doing keto, keep doing keto. But if it's not sustainable, I don't know what to tell you. If you're having some reaction to the food you're eating, if it's truly impossible to lose weight, you know,
yeah.
I don't think highly of the food in America. And I think, but even having said that, I think like there are ways to figure out an eating scheme that isn't harmful to each of us. I think, you know, unless you're like a little kid who has no control at all over what they're eating and their parents are just feeding them Fruit Loops 3 times a day. And then it's like, well, no, that kid's fucked. That kid's going to have a hard time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Good. That all makes sense. For anybody out there who's got a question, you can email it to us. It's hello@americanglutton.net.
Thanks for listening to this episode of American Glutton. I'm Ethan Suplee. You can follow us on Instagram @American Glutton Podcast. Sincerely.